Hello and welcome to edition number 2114 of the Whitney Talking News, which we are recording on a very warm evening, Thursday the 23rd of June 2026 at the High Street Methodist Church in Whitney. I'm Alan Revell, your editor this week. Beside me at the recording controls is Graham Diacon. And this week our four readers are Barbara Barringer, Marnie Leach, Adam Lethbridge and Byron Russell. We are grateful to the Whitney Gazette for many of the items we are using, as well as one or two fragments from the Chipping Norton News. And we'll begin with Marnie and a story from the Gazette about a new leisure facility.
Leaders thrilled as new sports park and cafe opens. Sports fans are keeping fit and having fun at a new leisure park, which has opened after a major improvement project. The Mayor of Whitney and the leader of the Town Council have both expressed their delight after the new courtside hub was opened at the Lees Recreation Ground in the town. For several years, the area in the popular park was under development, but now that it has been completed, it includes a community cafe called The Shed, with expanded seating, an indoor multi-purpose studio, and three full-size tennis, two netball, and four pickleball courts. In addition, covered paddle courts will have a new viewing terrace. There are new public toilets and changing rooms, and free-to-use facilities will include small basketball courts, table tennis tables, and improved access to the skate park. The project was led by Courtside, supported by Whitney Town Council, and the government's Community Ownership Fund. The council put £250,000 towards the scheme, and Ruth Smith, leader of the Whitney Town Council, said she was really pleased that it is fully open. She said, "The Town Council has supported Courtside's transformation of the coffee shed into this wonderful hub so that sport and recreation in Whitney can thrive in more dimensions than the council alone could provide. Whether it's training Whitney's next tennis and paddle stars, hosting sports teams and supporters, providing fitness classes in the studio, or keeping the coffee and freshly prepared meals coming, we will wonder how we ever did without it. I am really pleased that Courtside at the Lees is now fully open. Do spend the summer getting to know the Courtside team and getting involved with sport and community events." Meanwhile, Jane Doughty, the Mayor of Whitney, said she was absolutely thrilled. She said, "It is a brilliant facility, offering excellent customer service and a great selection, and it is already proving to be a huge asset to our wonderful town of Whitney. This new space will be enjoyed by people of all ages, bringing the community together in a positive and welcoming environment." I would just like to add that I absolutely agree with what the article is saying, because I went there twice this week. Some family went on Sunday because it was Father's Day, and I was so taken with it, I took a friend on Wednesday for a coffee.
Well, that's good. I think we'll all like to give it a go. Before I've introduced Byron, I should just let the listener at home know that you may hear a bit of swishing in the background, and that's actually the blinds that we've got in this room. And it's because we've got the windows open, because it's so warm, we're trying to get a little bit of air through. So that's just by way of explanation. So next is Byron with a story about a proposed new housing development which has caused some upset.
I'll say that again. Thanks, Alan. And the headline reads, 200 home bid will destroy peaceful nature of village. Objections have been raised over plans for 200 homes on West Oxfordshire farmland, with one saying they will destroy the peaceful nature of the village. The developers, MacMick Strategic Land Limited, have applied to West Oxfordshire District Council seeking permission for houses and a shop on 11.78 hectares of land near Standlake, just outside Witney. The parish of Standlake, which also includes Brighthampton Village, has a population of less than 1,600 people. The plan said the overriding vision for the site is to create a high-quality landscape-legged place that integrates with the existing landscape and context of Standlake to deliver a sustainable addition to the village for up to 200 dwellings, in addition to a small local convenience store. Previously, in 2018, a 100-home development was refused for the site amid sustainability concerns and fears about increased car use. Recent feedback included fear for safety issues and increased traffic at A Road junctions, creating particular risks near the primary school. A total of 19 objections and one supporting comment have been submitted. Alison Coley of Standlake said, "I strongly object to the proposed development at the Downs. This is an urban-scale development, completely disproportionate to the size and character of the village. The scale and density of this development will permanently destroy the peaceful nature of the village. The very large number of houses and the high density of the development are completely disproportionate to the existing village size and character. A development of 20 houses could be absorbed with minimal impact, but this is an order of magnitude too large for the village." Dr. James Milne of Standlake added, "Given the demonstrable lack of sewage and drainage capacity, the risk of increased pollution and flooding, and the failure to comply with national and local policy requirements, this proposal must be refused. Granting permission would result in unacceptable environmental harm and contravene established planning principles." However, project supporter Gemma Godfrey, also of Standlake, said, "I fully understand why some residents have concerns regarding the proposal. Many households currently enjoy open views across agricultural land, and any development will inevitably change that outlook. I recognise and respect those concerns, and I understand why those most immediately affected may object to the scheme. However, it's important, I believe, that the application is considered not only from the perspective of those neighbouring the site, but also from the perspective of the long-term future of the village as a whole. Whilst change can often be controversial, villages must evolve if they are to remain vibrant and sustainable places to live."
And now it's Barbara with a report about changing speed limits.
That's right. Speed limits reduced from 60 to 20 miles an hour on four roads. A 60 mile an hour speed limit on four Oxfordshire roads has been reduced to 20 miles an hour over safety fears for injury or death and massively increased traffic. On June the 18th, Transport boss Gareth Epps approved a raft of speed limit changes for the county. The largest decrease is set for the villages of Fordwells and Astle Lee in the Witney area. The approved changes cover unnamed roads and follow concerns from a parish council. They are being added to the roads running through Fordwells to Leefield to Swinbrook and extended through Astle Lee. It follows a wider scheme by Oxfordshire County Council to drop speed limits to 20 miles an hour to help promote alternative modes of transport for local travel. In a consultation on the limits, members of the public shared concerns about increased traffic. A resident said, "In the last few years, the volume, size, and significantly the speed of the vehicles passing through has increased enormously. On many occasions, the speed of some vehicles would cause serious injury or death if they were to strike a resident walking along. There is no footpath at all in the village. In addition, many of the residents in Fordwells are elderly. Another added, Fordwells is unusual in not having a speed limit lower than the national limit. Traffic has increased massively since the advent of sat-navs and the development of local businesses. Our cars have been involved in two accidents due to vehicles being driven too fast. I fully support a 20 miles an hour limit in Fordwells and the extension of the limit in Astley. I consider this to be long overdue. The council report said the proposals have been put forward for road safety reasons and aim to reduce vehicle speeds to safer levels for all motorists and road users, specifically those considered to be more vulnerable, including pedestrians, cyclists, equestrians and motorcyclists. During the meeting, Mr. Epps asked council officers about whether there should be a 20 miles an hour limit running all the way through Fordwells and Astley, following consultation concerns about a 260 metre gap where national speed limit would remain in place. A resident said, "Why the gap? This section of very narrow rural road, which is well used by cyclists." Mr. Epps was satisfied that cars could self-police with a national speed limit in the non-built-up areas between the villages. He said, "I'm very happy to approve the recommendation here."
Hello everyone, it's me again. Adam's been unavoidably detained, unfortunately, probably due to the hot weather, so I'm going to read the next piece. And the title is Yellow Submarines Got Talent Night Hailed. And I'll describe the picture first. We've got a group of young hopefuls who are obviously singing their heart out, and a picture of the Beatles' famous Yellow Submarine in the background. Budding stars showed off their talents at a cafe that supports people with learning disabilities and autism. Yellow Submarine, which has branches in Oxford and Whitney, raised £1,200 at its talent event to help support its work. Yellow Submarine's Got Talent saw 150 audience members treated to an evening of joy, laughter and unforgettable moments. Members of the charity, who all have learning disabilities or autism, took to the stage at the Corn Exchange in Whitney. From singing and dancing to comedy and even a spelling bee, every act brought something unique. A spokeswoman said, "For many of our members, stepping onto a stage in front of a packed audience was a huge achievement in itself. Watching people who have spent years building confidence through Yellow Submarine stand proudly in the spotlight was emotional for everyone in the room."
Council hails strong year of delivery. A council has delivered strong results in housing, waste services and community support. West Oxfordshire District Council reported 352 affordable homes in its latest performance report, surpassing its target of 274. It also recorded a success rate of more than 99.9% in scheduled bin collections. Andy Graham, leader of West Oxfordshire District Council, said, "We are continuing to deliver the services that matter most to residents while investing in the future of West Oxfordshire. Through careful financial management and efficiencies, we are able to deliver against local priorities and make meaningful improvements to our district
while maintaining high-quality services for our communities. Financial management enabled the council to operate under budget for the 2025-26 financial year. This allowed the authority to invest £342,000 into the West Oxfordshire Environmental Services Partnership and £440,000 into a hardship fund for residents on housing benefit or council tax support.
And now for not such a positive council news story. As the headline reads, and would you believe it, in this weather, heating left on as no one knew how to turn it off. A town council building has been found to have had the heating continually on because no member of staff knew how to turn it off. A report prepared for Witney Town Council in April found heating at the Corn Exchange Public Hall was left on overnight and during weekends. The reason? The one member of staff who knew how to operate the controls left over 6 months ago. A similar report was also presented from December with similar problems with the heating timer at the Windrush Cemetery Depot. Councillor David Edward Hughes said, "I find this completely unacceptable. If a local small business was run with this level of inefficiency, it wouldn't survive. Public bodies must be held to a higher standard of fiscal responsibility, not a lower one. Witney taxpayers deserve better than having their hard-earned money burned on heating empty rooms for months on end." The councillor confirmed training will be given to multiple members of staff to manage the system, ensuring that running the heating 24/7 due to staffing gaps never happens again. Mr. Edwards Hughes said, "While a backup plan should have been in place from the start, I am genuinely glad to see common sense prevailing and steps being taken to protect taxpayer money." Well, I really do hope that they've done their training and that the heating has been turned off for the sake of the staff working there and in the cemetery depot.
Clarkson talks about cancer with Cameron. TV presenter Jeremy Clarkson has revealed he has met up with former Prime Minister Lord David Cameron to discuss their prostate cancer diagnosis with other famous faces. The 66-year-old revealed in the latest episode of the fifth season of his series Clarkson's Farm that he had been diagnosed with aggressive prostate cancer that had been discovered early. In an interview with The Times, Clarkson confirmed that a PSA test 2 months ago revealed no indication of cancer and he is officially in remission. He said, "I was talking to David Cameron about it earlier this morning." He said the amount of people that come up to him is mostly in public conveniences and say, "If you hadn't owned up to it, I wouldn't have got checked and they wouldn't have found it." So now there's a group of us, the food writer, Giles Corran, David, me, one or two other people, and we meet for lunch every so often. Everybody has different Gleason scores, and everybody has different Stockholm and PSA scores. We all compare notes, and I actually get muddled with what mine were. But it is quite funny watching people looking at us and going, "That's quite an interesting group of people. What do they all share in common?" Clarkson went on to say that the news of his diagnosis has landed harder than I thought it would. He said, "This is why I have to say to everybody who's reading this, please, please, please go and get checked. It's not uncomfortable, it's not undignified, and it's a no-brainer. I did, and that's why I'm sitting here talking to you 11 months down the line. I've seen so many people die of cancer. It doesn't bear thinking about what it must be like to live knowing that an illness is going to kill you. It must be very, very, very distressing. I don't know the history of what happened to former Olympic cyclist Chris Hoy, but to be told your cancer is inoperable and to still carry on, you'd have to be incredibly brave. Speaking from a hospital bed at the end of the season finale," Clarkson revealed he had experienced complications during treatment, which he told the Times had been caused by him resuming a course of tablets he had been taking for his earlier vascular and cardiac problems. He said, "That was horrific, and it was all my own fault. I'd been on drugs for heart issues, and I had to come off them during the cancer treatment. 2 or 3 weeks after the cancer operation, I thought, I'd better put myself back on those blood thinners. Big mistake. Huge. It resulted in a very big emergency in the middle of the night. I'm not even going to go into the treatment that was required as a result of that, because it was horrible. I didn't ask a doctor. I just thought, I'm sure it would be all right to go back on blood thinners. The diagnosis came almost 2 years after Clarkson underwent a heart procedure, which saw him fitted with 2 stents to improve blood flow to the heart. And there's a nice picture of him, actually. He looks like he's drinking a glass of beer, and Clarkson looks like he's drinking a glass of wine, or maybe it's water, I don't know.
And as a consequence of Clarkson's revelation of his diagnosis, it does seem that public awareness has been raised. And the headline here reads, Clarkson diagnosis sees rise in health searches. Online searches for prostate cancer symptoms have surged following Jeremy Clarkson's recent health announcement. Searches rose by 733% on June the 17th, following Mr. Clarkson's disclosure of his aggressive prostate cancer diagnosis. Data analysed by urologist specialists at the Forbury Clinic suggested that the former Top Gear host's announcement prompted a sharp rise in public interest about the condition. Dr. Bob Yang, consultant urological surgeon at the Forbury Clinic, said, "Sometimes a health conversation does not begin in the doctor's office, but instead it starts with somebody seeing themselves reflected in a public figure's experience." 65 to 70% of all prostate cancer cases in the UK are diagnosed in men aged 65 or older. Jeremy Clarkson is indeed 66, with only 10% to 15% of all new cases affecting men below 60. However, it's common sense to start getting PSA checks from around 50, especially since prostate cancer is often caught late because its symptoms overlap with benign conditions. Although prostate cancer often develops without early warning signs, symptoms can include frequent urination, difficulty starting or stopping urination, a weak flow, or a sensation that the bladder has not fully emptied.
Turnraft refurbished to boost bird life at Whitney Lake. A tern raft has been refurbished to help conserve Whitney Lake as an important local wildlife site and support bird species. The floating platform at Whitney Lake and Country Park will provide a safe, undisturbed space for birds to nest away from predators and public activity, boosting their chances of breeding successfully. Recent maintenance has also improved the nearby boat launch, making it easier for Whitney Town Council's Green Spaces team to access the water and care for the raft. The team will now be able to use the boat for regular biodiversity checks around the lake, monitoring habitat health throughout the year. Whitney Town Council said, "Tern rafts are particularly valuable features for local wildlife. They provide an undisturbed resting and nesting space for birds away from predators and public footfall, helping to increase breeding success and support a wider range of species. Access to the lake by boat will also allow the team to reach the nature reserve section, where dense vegetation makes land surveys difficult. Surveying the site from the water offers a new perspective
and better understanding of habitat conditions. But the council reminds residents that swimming and paddling are not permitted at the lake.
And now for news of a dragon parade, and the headline reads, Dragon Parade Returns After 50 Years. Burford's dragon was revived for the first time in 50 years on Sunday for the traditional parade that dates back to AD 752. The procession went down the high street on Sunday as the town's festival continued to draw in the crowds under the sun. The Dragon Parade was a popular event commemorating a famous battle in Burford between King Ethelbald of Mercia and King Cuthred of the West Saxons in AD 752. For centuries, the town has commemorated the moment with a dragon-led procession, but it was stopped in the 1970s. The Dragon Parade was led down Burford Hill to the Living History Village at the primary school, where tea, cakes and drinks were available, courtesy of the Parent Teachers Association. Burford School Jazz Band and Bamford Morris Dancers performed. Burford Festival spokesman said, "A fabulous festival day in Burford. Huge thanks to all those who sponsored, took part, volunteered and came along to support." And there's a great picture showing about 12 Burfordians, if that's the word, leading a very, very large and dramatic dragon with a red head and tassels running all down its back. And everyone looks very, very happy indeed.
My article is headed, Man Arrested for Murder After Death of Woman in Her 50s. A man has been arrested on suspicion of murder after a woman was found dead at a home in Ensham. The woman, in her 50s, was initially found unresponsive in Daisy Crescent by paramedics on June 7th, before she was pronounced dead at the scene. Her death is being treated as unexplained by detectives leading the investigation, and a 58-year-old man, also from Ensham, has been arrested on suspicion of murder. Thames Valley Police did not say whether the victim and arrested man are known to each other. Thames Valley Police has also been asked for a statement as to why it did not inform the public for 2 weeks, given the seriousness of such an arrest. The force declined to say why, but revealed there is no further risk to the public. The man, who was arrested on suspicion of murder, has been released on bail, pending further inquiries from detectives. Community leaders in Ensham have also remained silent on the death when approached for a comment. Dan Levy, the Liberal Democrat County Councillor for Ensham, said the investigation is in the hands of Thames Valley Police and declined to comment further. Emergency services were called to the house on the new Abbey Green estate, where 77 new homes have recently been built and are priced up to £750,000. Police officers and paramedics from the South Central Ambulance Service were all called to the street at about 11:20 a.m. on Sunday, June the 7th. A police cordon was set up in the hours later while the initial stages of the investigation was launched and evidence was gathered. Little is known about the circumstances of the woman's death. A Thames Valley spokeswoman said officers were called by paramedics to Daisy Crescent, where the woman was found. Sadly, she died at the scene, she said. The woman's death is currently being treated as unexplained. Her next of kin have been informed and offered our support. A 58-year-old man from Ensham has been arrested on suspicion of murder and has been released on bail pending further inquiries. An investigation is ongoing and we leave this to be an isolated incident with no further risk to the public.
And my headline reads, Falkland Islands, students begin boarding. A group of Year 10 art students from the Falkland Islands have begun a new boarding experience. The students from the Falkland Islands Community School are settling into life at Burford School, one of the oldest schools in the country. Staff have praised the excellent first impression they have made so far, noting how quickly the group has unpacked and familiarised themselves with the routine of the boarding house. The school noted, "The buildings and setting have made a particularly strong impression. The Year 10 art students wish to express our sincere gratitude to the individuals and companies whose generous sponsorship and support made this opportunity possible." Burford School, founded in 1571 by the townsmen of Burford with merchant Simon Wisdom at their helm, initially offered an education to the sons of the ordinary men of Burford, charging fourpence, that's four old pence, of course, for enrolment and a further eightpence for the schooling per year. And there's a great picture which shows the entrance to Burford School and the group of students holding up a Falklands flag, which is blue with the Union Jack in the top left-hand corner and a shield showing what I take to be a sheep and a ship crossing the seas.
And next, it's our reflection for this week, and it's brought to you by Hilary Ewing of Oasis. And it's a contemporary subject, I believe.
Thank you very much. Good to be with you again. And I pay tribute to all those who are reading tonight because it's really, really hot. You've probably heard that the Mayor of Manchester, Andy Burnham, won last week's by-election in Makerfield, so that he could return to Parliament as a Labour MP to launch a leadership challenge. But you may not have heard about the hype and razzmatazz which accompanied that return. The BBC, with licence payers' money, filmed his train from a helicopter as if he were visiting royalty, or perhaps a film or pop star. When he arrived at Westminster, he took a photo of himself in front of a room packed with what looked like adoring fans, most of his colleagues on the Labour benches. The talk seems to be all about when he is Prime Minister and who might be in his cabinet. There are a number of aspects which I find odd, if not troubling. The leadership contest to replace Keir Starmer has not opened yet and does not close until the 16th of July. On two previous occasions, Andy Burnham stood in a leadership contest and lost, coming fourth when Ed Miliband was elected, and then later losing to Jeremy Corbyn. Although we don't have a presidential-style system here, we do like to have some idea of a manifesto. What does any challenger think about the economy? What are his or her views on the EU, on how jobs are to be secured, on foreign policy, on social and ethical matters? In this case, we don't really know. Then there's the presumption of it all. And I'm not playing party politics here, for similar things have happened in other parties. I can't help thinking that a quieter, more humble approach would be better. It may well be that Mr. Burnham is elected unopposed or wins a contest on his third attempt, and he will need the goodwill of the electorate to be successful in that difficult role. He's bound on occasions to get things wrong and to disappoint, for we are all flawed. As he was sworn in as an MP, someone shouted out, "You're not the Messiah," to which he replied, in the manner of a certain satirical film, "Just a naughty boy then." The true Messiah, Jesus, when he arrived in Jerusalem on Palm Sunday with crowds of his followers, did so in humility and gentleness, as foretold by the prophet Zechariah. "Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout, daughter of Jerusalem. See, your king comes to you, righteous and having salvation, gentle and riding on a donkey."
Thank you very much, Hilary. I must say I've had some of those thoughts myself about Mr. Burnham.
Thank you.
So that ends our first part of the programme. We'll be revisiting some news items from the Gazette and more broadly after this middle section, which is kicking off with me talking about, as the editor, talking about an experience I had this week and how it coincides with news and current affairs. So it's now a decade since the referendum which resulted in Britain leaving the European Union. The Vote Leave victory came as a shock to many, not least David Cameron, Lord Cameron, of course, who was so discombobulated that he quit as Prime Minister and our local MP. A succession of his colleagues then took the job on and mostly failed. There's a quiz question on this coming up. And now we await another new Prime Minister, probably Andy Burnham, an encouraging development for those who want the country to rejoin the EU, I think. Last week, coincidentally, 10 years to the day of the Brexit vote, my wife and I took the Eurostar to Brussels to see our youngest son, who now lives there. We queued in a non-EU passport and security line, but they seemed to move just as quickly. Of course, Belgium is synonymous with beer, waffles, mool and frites, which were embraced enthusiastically by us all. But Brussels is also the capital of the EU. Its shiny new headquarters and parliament are there. So we took a tram from the city centre and paid a visit. We spent much of our time in the Parlamentarium, an impressive multimedia guide through the heart of the parliament with immersive exhibits beginning with the rubble of World War II through European cooperation, how the parliament works and meeting today's challenges. Our tour guide was in fact our son, for whom payment came in the form of breakfast, lunch and dinner for the duration of our stay in his adopted city. He embodies what the Brexit vote meant for some young people and why his peer group remains such staunch Remainers. He is a biologist who has recently graduated with a master's in research and seemingly is set for a career in biology, with somebody lucky enough to employ him, says his proud father. But of course, he's no longer allowed to work in Europe, and he lives with his girlfriend, a French citizen, who is allowed to live and work in Belgium. However, their relationship means he might be granted a visa to do the same. On our first night in the city, a bar nearby was full of young people noisily watching their team in the World Cup on television. Belgium wasn't playing. The match was between France and Senegal. Brussels is home to more than 180 different nationalities of people, making it one of the world's most cosmopolitan cities. It seems to work. I hope for our son's sake they can make room for one more Brit. Next, it's quiz time. First, the answers to the last quiz, which was set by Byron, who is in the room, so he's not allowed to sing out the answers. They were mostly, if not all, multiple choice questions. I'll begin with his first one, which was June, the month of June, is named after the goddess Juno, the wife of Jupiter in Roman mythology. So the first question, what was she the goddess of? And he gave us three potential answers. One was women and family. B was agriculture and crops. And C was fields and meadows. Does anybody other than Byron in this room know what the answer is?
I guess that's B.
Well, you're wrong. It's women and family. So,
this is the room to think that much about that.
Well, indeed. So, second question, June the 19th or Juneteenth is an American holiday and it celebrates what? Is it A, the Declaration of Independence, B, the Battle of Gettysburg, or C, the abolition of slavery? Anyone want to have a stab at that? No?
In the modern climate, the abolition of slavery?
It is the abolition of slavery. Question three. George Orwell's classic 1984 was published in June of which year? Was it 1948? Was it 1933? Or was it 1949? Anyone know for sure? No. So I'm going to tell you. It was 1949. In 1956, on June the 5th, Elvis Presley first publicly performed which famous song? Was it and I'm not going to sing them. Blue Suede Shoes, Hound Dog, or Jailhouse Rock? Anybody know?
Jailhouse Rock.
It wasn't. It was Hound Dog. Okay. We have none out of four. One out of four, perhaps, in this room. Last question from Byron. D-Day, or Operation Overlord, marked a turning point in World War II and took place in June 1944. But on which date? Was it June the 1st, June the 6th, or June the 9th?
6th.
Graham confidently says June the 6th, and he is correct. Thank you. Now, for my quiz, for which I hope nobody shouts out the answers, and it starts inevitably with a couple of political questions. Since David Lord Cameron's departure after the Brexit referendum, Britain has had 5 prime ministers. Can you name them? And for a bonus point, in the correct order. So, question 2. The likely new prime minister, as we've discussed, is Andy Burnham. For which city was he mayor before his recent election as an MP? And I think if you refer back to what was said earlier in our programme, the answer's there. My third question, on Wednesday and again on Thursday, the day we're recording, the UK reached a new record June temperature. What is the new high? You probably have to listen to the radio to get the answer to that, but I'm sure it will be talked about. Question 4. Thomas Tuchel, who is the manager of England football team, was the manager of which English Premier League football club before taking over the England job? And question 5, final one. The Wimbledon Tennis Championships start on Monday. Who won the men's singles title last year, and what is his nationality? So now it's our notice board. There are no listeners with birthdays in the coming week. There were, however, 10 deaths reported in the Gazette, and they were Christopher Tolley, who has died aged 66, James Wally, known as Jim, who was 77, John Wharton has died, aged 72. Friends have been invited to wear a hat and a waistcoat in tribute to John's dress sense at a Thanksgiving service to be held at St Mary's in Whitney on the 6th of October. Peter Claude Batts died on the 23rd of May, aged 87. Irene Coombs, née Dane, died on the 8th of June, aged 86. Larry Green died on the 5th of June, also aged 86. And Anthony Povey, known as Tony, of Carterton, died on the 9th of June, aged 67. Richard Simpson died on the 10th of June, aged 82. And David, or Dave, Saul, died on the 7th of June, at the age of 87. And finally, Barry Leslie Taylor of Whitney, previously of Bampton, died on the 7th of June, aged 92. Our condolences to family and friends. And now we move on to part 2 of our news items, and the first we will hear from is Marnie.
Pothole Queen Liz makes road fixes guarantee. Oxfordshire's new self-described pothole queen has made a guarantee to the county amid its road repairs crisis and ongoing backlog. Liz Lethman was leader of Oxfordshire County Council for 5 years and stepped down from the role last month, taking on the newly created position of Cabinet Member for Highways, Construction and Repair. The job had been dubbed Pothole Czar, but she says she prefers the title of Pothole Queen. This restructuring split up the transport boss role previously held by Andrew Gant
in a move Ms. Leffman hopes will ensure greater efficiency to tackle the highways situation, which has seen road users warning of craters and danger, including Transport Secretary Heidi Alexander, after her Mini Cooper was damaged. There remains a 4,000 pothole backlog in the county, which Ms. Leffman hopes to see filled by the end of this month. She also says the council will be resurfacing lots of roads over the summer, which should mean we won't have as many potholes to worry about this winter. Ms. Leffman said while she cannot guarantee the weather and its impact on the roads, I hope we can guarantee that we will manage that more efficiently with longer and more long-lasting and more resistant pothole fillings. She said, over time, we will get on top of this problem.
And now another item about potholes. And according to the title, it looks as though you're damned if you do and cursed if you don't. So pothole fillers hit, sworn at and spat on, says Boss. Workers out on Oxfordshire highways filling potholes have been hit, sworn at and spat on while on the job. And it's getting worse, according to an infrastructure boss. The county, which has received repeated calls for action on its highways, including from the Prime Minister, sees more than 1,000 emergency pothole reports a week. According to the County Council, there has been a major rise in repairs, with the number of crews increased from 7 to 25 to tackle its pothole backlog. Since January 2026, contractor M Group has repaired more than 33,000 highway defects, compared to 37,000 potholes filled in the whole of 24-25. But this rise in repairs has also come with rising abuse towards the people carrying out the work. Richard Lovewell, M Group Business Director, said, "It just makes me really, really sad. I think what makes me even sadder is the guys expect it now and they just think it's part of the job. And nobody should come to work to be spat at and abused." He said, "These guys work very, very hard in all weathers and all environments. We appreciate that if we're out with traffic management, it can cause some inconvenience. But there's people getting hit, there's people getting sworn at, and we're doing everything we possibly can. We've brought in body-worn video. We use static CCTV, anything we can do," he added. "We recently had a high-speed police chase come straight through one of our sites. It's one of the major hazards. These incursions, we obviously shut roads off, and people don't take any notice of that, and if that's their shortcut, that's their shortcut. What they've got to realise is that they're putting lives in danger by doing it. Let's be honest, if you worked in a bank, you wouldn't expect people to line up and swear at you all day." Mr. Lovewell wants to address public perception about pothole roadworks, saying, "If we could, we'd resurface every road in Oxfordshire. Obviously, as a contractor, we get given certain budgets." He added, "If a pothole fails for any reason, from a workmanship issue or anything, we repair that free of charge, and that's our risk. I don't think people know that." He also highlighted some of the better experiences the workers have had while out on the job. Young children are often fascinated by the roadworks. Mr. Lovewell said members of his work gangs take time to chat to the kids and tell them what they're doing. He said kids especially like the Dragon Patcher, a huge fire-breathing pothole machine.
My headline is Medical Group Celebrates 50 Years. Health professionals marked a milestone with a day of community spirit and celebration. Ensham Medical Group hosted a fun and wellbeing fair to mark the 50th anniversary of purchasing the old vicarage garden where the practice was built. The event brought together a range of community organisations and businesses focused on health and well-being, including social groups, holistic therapists and a local gym. Dr. Emma Ladds of Ensham Medical Group said, "The sun was out, the banners were up, and Ensham Medical Group GP practice welcomed their local community to a fun and well-being fair. This was a celebration to mark the 50th anniversary of buying the old vicarage garden to build the new practice, and it was a joyous event. Visitors enjoyed games such as pin the organ on the body and guess the number of pills in the jar, as well as a raffle run by the patient participation group. And there's a very nice picture showing everybody enjoying themselves and three particular people that are running the raffle, and they look very, very happy."
And my headline reads, "Electric car giant NIO opens centre in town." An electric vehicle maker has opened a base celebrating a decade of innovation. NIO has opened a new research and development centre in Witney, its latest milestone in 10 years of engineering in the UK. The 9,460 square foot facility brings together more than 40 engineers under one roof and consolidates the company's UK operations. NIO Europe Vice President Wei Zhang said, "For a decade, our Oxfordshire team has been an integral part of NIO's, or NIO's, global R&D network, contributing to multiple vehicle programs and engineering innovations across our global portfolio. As we celebrate this milestone, we thank the team for its dedication, expertise and contribution to NIO's development over the past 10 years. The opening of our new Witney R&D Centre reflects our long-term commitment to the UK, Europe and international collaboration in advancing smart electric mobility." And there is a photo showing all the employees at the new NIO Centre, including a picture of Vice President Wei Zhang and Witney Town Mayor.
Redknapp tackles council on England flag court ban. Football legend Harry Redknapp has slammed Oxfordshire County Council as it seeks to ban flying England flags on lampposts and public property through court action. The authority has applied to the High Court for an injunction to prevent the continued unauthorised placement of flags on or near roads as England's World Cup campaign ramps up. It called out the Raise the Colours group, which for the past year has been putting up flags across Oxfordshire, even after the council has taken them down. Oxfordshire County Council described the flags as distressing and issued a formal legal notice to the group in March, insisting they stop. Speaking on the Daily Telegraph's podcast, host Camilla Tominey described the Liberal Democrat-led administration as spoilsport, before adding, "What is wrong with these people?" Harry Redknapp, who was on the podcast, reacted by calling the councillors stupid with idiotic opinions. Mr. Redknapp, who began his managerial career as an assistant coach to Bobby Moore at Oxford City in the late 1970s, said, "We are proud to be British. That is what we are. Fly the flags, be proud of your country. Don't worry about these stupid councillors who have idiotic opinions. We are proud to be British. Don't be ashamed to be British." Council leader Tim Bearder declined to respond to the comments until after the High Court judge delivers his verdict on Tuesday.
A civil injunction is a court order that requires an individual or organisation to stop specified activities. If granted, it would prohibit further unauthorised installations on or near the highway and allow the council to take enforcement action if the order is breached. Oxfordshire County Council said its staff have been subject to abuse and harassment by Raise the Colours members when they are taking the flags down. Mr. Bearder previously said, "This activity is not about national pride or unity. It is unlawful behaviour which has caused fear and division within our communities. We have a clear responsibility to keep people safe and ensure our public spaces are welcoming and inclusive for everyone." Newspaper columnist Alison Pearson said, "I'm afraid as the World Cup progresses, the poor Lib Dems may be exposed to rather a lot of England flags." As of January the 15th, Oxfordshire County Council had spent £16,585 on removing 396 flags from streetlights. It had also received 223 complaints on the Fix My Street portal relating to flags being attached to the highways and on street furniture.
And my headline is more news about Thames Water, but this time it's about water usage in these heated days. Hose pipes, sprinklers and showers are driving up water use, Thames Water has claimed. No surprise there. Rising temperatures and drought have not curbed water habits across the UK, with millions using more water than a year ago. According to new research from Thames Water, 7 million people, 13% of the population, report higher year-on-year water use, despite drought conditions and the hottest summer on record in 2025. Andrew Tucker, water reduction manager at Thames Water, said, "We're seeing the impact of hotter, drier weather across the UK, and while more people are aware of the need to save water, this isn't always reflected in usage. The main reasons for increased water use include more frequent bathing and showering, 28%, gardening and watering plants, 27%, and extra household cleaning, 26%. Nearly 1 in 10 people still use lawn sprinklers during the summer, with each sprinkler using up to 166 litres of water every 10 minutes. Average water consumption in the Thames Water region stands at around 140 litres per person per day. The national target is to reduce this to 122 litres by 2038. Mr. Tucker said, "At Thames Water, we're continuing to invest in leak reduction, smart meter installations, water efficiency and mains replacement as part of our biggest upgrade in 150 years for the benefit of our customers and the environment. We can't do this alone. It's important that customers and businesses work with us to save water where they can and play their part in protecting our vital resources." A surge in demand was recorded during the second May bank holiday weekend, with temperatures reaching their peak on May the 25th and driving more than 1 billion litres of extra water use across London and the South East. Water-saving habits are not widely taught, the survey found, with 36% of adults saying they were not taught how to save water and 34% not encouraged to do so as children. Thames Water recommends simple ways to save water over the summer, including fixing leaks, turning off taps while brushing teeth, switching to watering cans instead of hose pipes or sprinklers, and watering gardens early in the morning or late in the evening.
It is currently delivering its largest infrastructure upgrade in 150 years, and this includes pipe replacement, leak reduction, and accelerated smart meter installation across the Thames Valley. To date, more than 1.3 million smart meters have been installed, identifying over 135,000 customer-side leaks.
My headline is, former PM wins planning battle for huge veg patch. Former Prime Minister Lord Cameron has won a planning battle for a large vegetable patch at his home in West Oxfordshire. Whitney's former Conservative MP and his wife, Lady Samantha Cameron, wanted to replace a dilapidated greenhouse at their house, excuse me, in Dean, and build a new area to grow their own produce after becoming more green-fingered in recent years. His latest planning success comes just weeks after winning a six-year fight for a swimming pool, where neighbours accused him of creating a tacky Benidorm resort in his garden. The application to West Oxfordshire District Council outlined how greener Lord Cameron has become since stepping back from frontline politics. His representatives wrote, "The applicants have become more green-fingered and would like a dedicated area for a greenhouse, garden tools and garden machinery. The vegetable garden would be made up of oak beams and brick to form a total of 10 raised beds." The statement added, "The proposals create a coherent and discreet arrangement of new outbuildings, a dedicated greenhouse and a vegetable garden that together enhance the practical use and enjoyment of the applicant's property. The outbuildings are modest in scale, constructed from sympathetic materials and carefully sited behind existing structures and woodland to ensure minimal visual impact on the wider village and conservation setting. Overall, the scheme makes a sensitive and efficient use of an underutilised part of the garden, while strengthening the property's character and amenity. No public objections were raised, and planners accepted a plea from Lord Cameron's representative to approve the scheme quickly. And there's a very nice picture of David Cameron of Dean Lane Farm near his home, and he's feeding a lamb a bottle of milk.
Interesting story. So perhaps next week we'll hear that David Cameron has joined the Greens, or not, perhaps. That concludes pretty much this week's edition. Now, thanks again, as usual, go to the Whitney Gazette for most of the articles we've used. My thanks go to our readers, Barbara Barringer, Marnie Leach and Byron Russell. Adam couldn't make it in the end. And this recording has been made possible by the chap beside me, Graham Diacon. Our admin team earlier in the programme, or before the programme started, were Valerie T and Jan Butler. And that's all for this week. But before we go, as usual, we'll finish with a joke. Now, this joke has been pre-rehearsed on the audience in front of me. I didn't get too many laughs. So I hope you get a bit of a giggle out of it. So it's the end of the day and it's getting dark outside. That bit's important. And a podiatrist is just about to close his consulting room when a moth flies in, and he turns out to be a talking moth. The moth says, "Doc, I need your help. My wife wants to leave me. My daughter is marrying someone I hate. My son blames me for his problems. And my other son won't even speak to me. I'm at my wit's end." The podiatrist, looking puzzled, says, "Well, that sounds terrible. Clearly you have a world of problems. But why do you come to me?" The moth says, "Well, your light was on." Boom, boom. Finally, before we go, I'd recommend listening to the Desert Island Discs radio programme on Gary O'Donoghue, the BBC's chief North America correspondent, who himself has struggled with his vision and is now almost completely blind. It was an uplifting, positive tale of O'Donoghue's triumphs and successes against the odds, and you can find it on the BBC Sounds app. That's a Desert Island Discs programme from about 4 weeks ago. So, keep listening at the end of the programme for highlights of this week's best radio and TV watching. And I know everyone here at Whitney Talking News would like to wish you well. And so until our next edition, we will all say goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you so much.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Now for a look at some of this coming week's radio highlights, starting with Saturday, June 27th. And a drama at a choice of times, the dramatisation of the Booker Prize-winning 1984 novel by Anita Bruckner, Hotel de Lac, about a Swiss refuge for the aged and disgraced, are an unlikely setting for romance. It can be heard at 6 o'clock in the morning, 11 o'clock or 5 p.m. Saturday, Radio 4 Extra. More drama at 3 o'clock with Hashtag Public Enemy. The Norfolk town of Bramwich is hoping to restore its fortunes with an eco-village to include holiday homes and an aquapark, but the grand opening is jeopardised by the discovery of toxic waste in the water. Hashtag Public Enemy, Radio 4, 3 o'clock, Saturday afternoon. Opera on 3 brings us a recent Royal Opera House performance of Wagner's Siegfried, the third instalment of the Ring cycle. Siegfried's been raised by the scheming mime, whose ulterior motive is to get him to reforge his father's sword, slay the dragon, and steal the cursed ring. 6 o'clock, Radio 3, for Opera on 3. Sunday, June 28th, Lauren Laverne's castaway on this week's Desert Island Discs is DJ and musician Norman Cook. Radio 4, 10 a.m. Ahead of this year's BBC Proms, Sakari Aramo, chief conductor of the BBC Symphony Orchestra, explores the act of listening to music. What are we doing when we listen and what we actually hear? Radio 3 for this, 3 o'clock, Sunday afternoon. Drama on Sunday is Finn Family, Moomin Troll, Robin Brooks' dramatisation of the third Moomin book. Spring has come to Moomin Valley and the legendary Hobgoblin has lost his magic hat. The drama, Radio 4, 3 o'clock. An actor and author, Patterson Joseph, investigates the extraordinary life of Billy Waters, a 19th century London street performer whose great talent as a fiddler, singer and dancer made him a household name. The Sunday feature, King of the Beggars, music of Billy Walters, 7 o'clock, Radio 3, Sunday night. On to programmes then that are broadcast each day at the same time, same radio station. So every day, Monday to Friday, same time, same radio station. Dramatisation of Agatha Christie's Murder on the Orient Express can be heard each weekday on Radio 4 Extra. Again, a choice of times for this drama, 6 o'clock in the morning, 11 a.m. or 5 p.m. Thomas Jefferson, the third president of the United States, is the subject of Mr. Jefferson's Library. Michael Goldfrab visits the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C., and his home in Virginia to tell the story of how Jefferson's love of reading shaped the American Revolution and the beginnings of American history. Mr. Jefferson's Library, 11:45, each weekday, on Radio 4. Now, if you're a sports fan, you'll know that the World Cup is continuing throughout the week, and the Wimbledon tennis tournament starts this week as well. You can tune in to coverage each weekday on Radio 5 from 1 p.m. Justin Rowlett looks at important conflicts in the history of environmental protests, starting with one of Extinction Rebellion's first ever actions, occupying an office building in North London. 10 fights that made the Green Movement. 1:45 all week, Radio 4. Composer of the week is Leonard Bernstein, 1918 to 1990. Donald MacLeod explores the life and music of a key figure in the formation of America's modern cultural identity. Composer of the Week, Radio 3, Monday to Friday, 4 p.m. And a look at the impact of island life on the creative process as Clive McIntyre visits five British islands. He begins his journey on his home island in the Isle of Mull. The essay, Our Island Music, 9:45, each weeknight on Radio 3. On to the individual programmes then to listen to through the week, going back to Monday, June 29th. There's a new series, Common Ground, in which Evan Davis travels across the UK to explore social cohesion and learn about the issues that create division. Radio 4, 9 a.m. The Patch, in which a random postcode generator picks an area in the UK, this week features a roadside shrine in Greater Manchester and discovers the remarkable story behind it. 11 a.m, Radio 4, for the patch on Monday. And Radio 3 in concert on Monday night features a concert recorded on May 14th at the BBC Hoddington Hall in Cardiff. BBC National Orchestra of Wales in Strauss's Tod und Verklärung, Death and Transfiguration, and Beethoven's First Violin Concerto in D. The concert starts on Radio 3 at 7:30 Monday night. Tuesday, June 30th, the drama Our Friends in the North, Peter Flannery's own adaptation of his award-winning 1996 TV drama, continues on the radio. The year is 1979. Mary and Tosca are barely holding it together for the children. Nicky's trying to get selected as a candidate for the Labour Party. Our Friends in the North, Radio 4, 2:15. Also on Tuesday, Lady on Trial with Lucy Worsley looks at the life of suffragette Annie Kenney. Having worked in a cotton mill from the age of 10, she became involved in the movement after hearing a speech by Christabel Pankhurst. Radio 4 for Lady on Trial with Lucy Worsley, 3 o'clock, Tuesday. In Poetry Please this week, Roger McGough and Lem Sise celebrate the life of Mersey poet Brian Patton, who died in September, aged 79. Poetry Please, Radio 4, 4 p.m. What's Up Docs, in which Chris and Zan van Tuchelen explore heart palpitations, what they feel like and how to tell if they're serious, is on Radio 4 at 4:30 on Tuesday. And obviously, as it is Tuesday, In Touch with Peter White, the news for the blind and partially sighted, 8:40, Radio 4, Tuesday evening. Wednesday, July 1st, Stolen Years tells the story of Andrew Malkinson, who spent 17 years in prison for a crime he didn't commit. He tries to rebuild his life. Malkinson sets out to learn how he was wrongly identified. Stolen Years, Wednesday morning, 9:30, Radio 4. The drama on Wednesday, Keeping the Wolf Out, in three weekly parts. Philip Palmer's crime drama set in communist Hungary in the 1960s. Special investigator Bertalan is assigned a new boss, while his wife, Francisca, hears that a senior officer from Romanian security is about to arrive at the ministry. 2:15, Radio 4, Keeping the Wolf Out, in three different parts. Thursday, July 2nd, and drama Missing, Presumed, Drowned, based on the book by Stefano Paolini about an almost forgotten tragedy of the Second World War, which tells of the events surrounding the sinking of the Anna Dorna Star, a converted passenger liner carrying hundreds of interned Italians being deported from the UK to Canada in July 1940. The drama is on Radio 4 at 2:15 on Thursday afternoon. And ramblings this week, Claire Balding joins Alistair McNichol for part of his long-distance walk from Holborn in London to Tong in Shropshire, inspired by the journey made by little Nell and her grandfather in Dickens' old curiosity shop. Ramblings, 3 o'clock, Thursday afternoon, Radio 4. And Friday, July 3rd, you can hear the final part of Limelight, The Courier, drama at 2:15. When his worst fears are realised, Mo has just 24 hours to gather up all the evidence he can find before he has to give himself up. Limelight, The Courier, 2:15, Radio 4, Friday afternoon. And as this week's radio recommendations come to an end, Friday night is indeed Music Night, and another chance to hear a concert of Nordic summer music recorded in June 2025 at Snake Maltings in Suffolk. Works performed by the Iceland Philharmonic Choir and the BBC Concert Orchestra include Nielsen's Like a Patch of Green Grass, Springtime on Funen, Lindbergh's Compare Thee to a Summer Day, and Grieg's Give to All Gods a Grace Cup of Gratitude. That's it. Thank you to Angela for the highlights this week. May I wish you a peaceful, safe and enjoyable one of radio listening.
Hello, this is Val from Wharfdale Talking News with my selection of audio-described TV programmes for the period Saturday 27th of June to Friday 3rd of July 2026. This week, as well as coverage of the Football World Cup, the first week of Wimbledon starts on Monday, so these events could affect the programme schedules on BBC One, BBC Two and ITV One. Also, for football fans, at the time of going to press, when the tournament enters the knockout stages, BBC One and ITV One had not decided which games they will each show, so you need to check nearer the time if you want to catch a specific match. Also, some of the programmes I have listed for these channels may not happen because of this uncertainty. Not all the football is audio described, and none of the tennis appears to be. But hopefully the commentary should give you an idea of the action. So let's start with Saturday, 27th of June. A triple bill of The Simpsons starts at 11:50 a.m. on Channel 4. Holmes Under the Hammer is on BBC One at 12 noon with Bargain Hunt at 1:15. A choice of afternoon films. On BBC One at 3:25 is Roald Dahl's The Witches, or over on BBC Two at 4 p.m, the sci-fi drama Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and on ITV One at 5 p.m, the period drama Downton Abbey. In the aftermath of the complaint, can Dylan make things right with Stevie and Matty? Find out in Casualty on BBC One at 8:10. This is followed by the final two episodes of the drama 2 Weeks in August on BBC One at 9 p.m, when Zoe embarks on a search for answers and is forced to make an impossible choice. Yvonne overcomes injury to win the Wimbledon singles in the final episode of Goolagong on BBC Four at 9 p.m. Robin and Harry look to a policeman for help with finding Ollie in the drama The Boy That Never Was on the U and Drama Channel at 10 p.m. The World Cup match tonight, Panama versus England, is on ITV One, kick-off 10 p.m. On to Sunday, 28th of June. Sunday with Laura Koonsberg, featuring interviews with politicians and key public figures, is on BBC One at 9 a.m. A man is found boiled to death in a vat at a new brewery in Midsummer Murders at 1:10 on ITV One. In Monterey Bay, sea otters navigate to reach a bed of mussels. The Americas is on BBC One at 2:45 p.m. World Cup Match of the Day Live, Group Runner-Up versus Group B Runner-Up, is on either BBC One or ITV One, kick-off 8 p.m, and so the following BBC One and ITV One programmes may change. The wildlife filmmaker crosses the Gobi Desert with his camels Chewy and Squeaks for company. My Epic Camel Adventure with Gordon Buchanan is on BBC Two at 8 p.m. In Death in Paradise at 9 p.m. on BBC One, Neville investigates when Florence's undercover role takes a dangerous turn. A jury must decide if a body found in a disused warehouse was murdered. Murder trial is on BBC Two at 9 p.m. In the final episode of the documentary series Free Nelson Mandela on Channel 4 at 9 p.m, we discover how a 1988 BBC concert marking Mandela's 70th birthday raised worldwide awareness. Here are those programmes which are on at the same time throughout the week. On BBC One, Holmes Under the Hammer is at 11:15 a.m. and Bargain Hunt is at 12:15, each day apart from Wednesday. Live coverage of the tennis from Wimbledon starts on BBC One at 2 p.m. each day, apart from Wednesday when it starts at 11:15 a.m. Over on BBC Two, live coverage starts at 10:30 on Monday, 11 a.m. Tuesday, 1 p.m. Wednesday, and back to 11 a.m. Thursday and Friday. However, the tennis schedules could be changed depending on live coverage of the World Cup. Dickinson's Real Deal is on ITV One at 2:15 p.m. Monday to Friday. On Channel 4, there are 4 episodes of the sitcom Frasier, starting at 9:10 each morning, Monday to Friday. On ITV 3, there are 2 episodes of Heartbeat, starting at 5:50 and 6:55 p.m. Monday to Friday. Now for the soaps. If there is no football on BBC One, EastEnders will be on BBC Two at 7:30pm Monday to Thursday. If there is no football on ITV One, Emmerdale will be at 7:30 on Monday and 7:45 Tuesday and Wednesday. Coronation Street will be at 8pm on Monday, 8:45 on Tuesday and 8:15 Wednesday. Now for Monday, 29th of June. There are two World Cup Match of the Day live programmes today. Group C winner versus Group F runner-up. Kick-off 6pm. And Group E winner versus third place group A, B, C, D or F. Kick-off 9:30pm. In Dover, 24/7, Britain's busiest port, on Channel 4 at 8pm, police officers chase a man who spotted jumping out of a lorry. The theft of a family heirloom leaves Ray and Trudy Nielsen with blood on their hands. The Brokenwood Mysteries is on the U and Drama Channel at 8pm. When newlywed Sean fails to return from surfing, police conclude he fell foul of the riptides and drowned. But did something more sinister happen? The four-part drama Riptide starts tonight on Channel 5 at 9pm and continues at the same time Tuesday to Thursday. The historian charts the events of 1605 in the documentary The Gunpowder Plot, Lucy Worsley Investigates, on BBC Two at 9pm. A treat for any David Hockney fans tonight, with an evening of programmes to celebrate his life and work, starting at 9pm on BBC Four with a definitive profile of the artist from 2015, followed by David Hockney: A Life in Art, the interview at 10:45, and Hockney: Double Portrait at 11:10. On BBC Two at 10pm, another chance to join Bob and Paul in the Lake District in Mortimer and Whitehouse Gone Fishing. Tuesday, 30th of June. Two more World Cup matches today in the knockout stages with kickoffs at 6pm and 10pm. Alice Roberts follows archaeologists as they uncover an Iron Age chariot. Digging for Britain is on BBC Two at 8pm. The community mourns a beloved resident as Eve struggles with guilt. The Light in the Hall, Still Water, is on Channel 4 at 9pm. The final episode is at the same time tomorrow. Washington's Continental Army fight the British Army in the inconclusive Battle of Monmouth. The documentary series The American Revolution is on Channel 5 at 10pm. This is followed by a documentary examining how London overcame a series of disastrous events in the 17th century. London: A Tale of Two Cities with Dan Cruikshank is on Channel 5 at 11:30pm. On to Wednesday, the 1st of July. Three more World Cup matches today in the knockout stages with kickoffs at 5pm, 9pm and 4am. Professor Brian Cox continues his exploration of the universe with a journey into a supermassive black hole. Universe is on Channel 5 at 8pm. A crew responds to a mayday in the English Channel in Saving Lives at Sea on BBC Two at 9pm. An art gallery manager is found dead in this first episode of a two-parter of The Chelsea Detective on the U and Drama Channel at 9pm. Part two is at the same time tomorrow. Thursday, 2nd of July. Two more World Cup matches today in the knockout stages with kickoffs at 8pm and midnight. Joanna's journey leads her to Slovakia. Joanna Lumley's Danube is on ITV1 at 7:15pm. More items are brought into the repair shop at 8pm on BBC Two. The architect meets a couple who put their life savings into a disused electrical substation tower in Cornwall. George Clark's Remarkable Renovations is on Channel 4 at 8 p.m. When a former Met police officer is fatally stabbed, DCI Stanhope retraces the victim's steps to find the truth. Vera is on ITV3 at 8 p.m. In 1992, a tragic suicide turns into a murder investigation, and Eddie Guilfoyle is imprisoned for life for the murder of his pregnant wife. As he tries to clear his name, he uncovers profound problems with his conviction. The Accused, Beyond Reasonable Doubt, is on Channel 4 at 10 p.m. More World Cup matches today in the knockout stages, and we're on to Friday the 3rd of July now. So the kickoffs start at 7 p.m, 11 p.m. and 2:30 a.m. Amanda and the girls go on a camping trip under the stars in Swaledale. Our farm next door, Amanda, Clive and Kids, is on Channel 4 at 8 p.m. A double bill of Doc Martin starts on ITV3 at 8 p.m. Louisa and Martin find themselves tasked with homework after their first therapy session. A cast of famous faces give their thoughts on the week's TV. Celebrity Gogglebox is on Channel 4 at 9 p.m. Actor James waits for his big moment in a static caravan owned by a strange family. Inside Number 9 is on BBC Two at 10 p.m. I must admit that this week has been a bit of a struggle due to the World Cup coverage affecting BBC One and ITV. Plus, there seem to be less audio-described programmes available. And as usual, lots of repeats. Fingers crossed you manage to find something you might like.
DNF Soundings.